I'm Wayne.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Stargate Pioneer from the Starling Tribune.
A podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network.
Just like the one you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of each individual.
Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
And get ready, because geekiness begins in 3,
2,
1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten.
You guys suck.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Flashy lights, Christmas, woo!
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 130 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we combine our loves for Renaissance art, red wine, speed aging chicken, primordial soup, and green squid into a sarcastic romp through Earth's history. What else could you hope for when on a holiday with a grinning madman where the travel agenda has been planned out by the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? I am Jay, and with me in the GPR studios tonight is Keir. How are you doing, Keir?
Fantastic, sir. Yourself?
Doing outstanding. And Haley, how are you tonight, ma'am?
Excellent.
Ma'am. Welcome to adulthood.
Oh, well, this week, we throw caution to the wind, take the advice of a clear and certain lunatic, and let Keir pick the Doctor Who viewing.
You're all doomed!
As the kickoff to our favorites arc, we begin at the beginning. Literally, the beginning of life on Earth. If you choose to accept the writer's proposal that all life began as the result of a botched spaceship takeoff. But don't worry, it's really easy to make the connection between irradiated amino acids, time travel, and 6 copies of the Mona Lisa. No, really.
Yeah, all makes perfect sense.
I wrote it in felt tip. We decided a little while ago that we were going to spend some time talking about not necessarily just individual stories or episodes that we were really keen on, but arcs, either short or long term, that really appealed to us individually. And I have to, you know, being sort of one of the token representatives of the classic era, I had to go back to one that I think I am definitely not alone in feeling is one of the signature storylines from the classic series, and that's Tom Baker's City of Death. So tons has been said. We've mentioned it on countless occasions when we've had the opportunity, or I should say when I've had the opportunity to promote it in the past. But being obviously, you know, Tom Baker being my doctor, Douglas Adams being one of the authors that was just absolutely pivotal in my emergence into sci-fi geekdom when I was probably about 10 or 11 years old, on my first pass through all of the inaptly named Hitchhiker's trilogy of 5 books, this was everything that I absolutely love about that period in the show's legacy. So, so I don't know, Haley, as one who's sort of been backing into classic Who, was this your first watch through in its entirety?
Yes, this is my first Baker episode that I've seen.
Nice. Okay.
Awesome.
Yep.
All right. Well served, I think. And Jay, I know you've gone through this tour a number of times.
Oh yeah.
But and we'll get to this. Actually, it's a news item that we have for later in the day. There's all kinds of interesting backstory with regards to Douglas Adams' involvement, or David Agnew, as you want to refer to, a nice little nom de plume. But there's, you know, there's interesting stories about that when he was given the opportunity to do the writing, because he also wrote never actually lifetime aired Shada and those things, that he had gotten through 3 of 4 of these stories, and sort of the interesting accounts as to his experience by the time he got back to all of the edits and the rewrites that were being requested at the time. So if you ever, if you're ever interested in doing some research online about his involvement with the shows in the back in the late 70s, this was 1979. It's just interesting stuff all around. Also bear in mind, that a lot of around the period that this was releasing, you've just now come off the heels of the popularity of the first release of episode 4 of Star Wars on a cinematic release. Just all kinds of, it was a huge time for large scale science fiction productions and things of that sort. And I think that's one of the reasons why BBC was given the opportunity to do some location filming, and they said, well, what the hell, we'll go across the English Channel, we'll do some filming in Paris. We're not really sure exactly what we're going to do with it yet, but we're going to get a hell of a lot of footage of people, you know, on practical locations,
yeah,
running around a lot.
Yeah, that's one thing that got to me. I was like, you know, it's great that they were in Paris, and it adds to the look, and you really feel like, okay, this is where they're at and everything like that, and it just... But when you sit there and watch it, you're like, so all they did the entire time they were in Paris was just, here, let's set up the camera here and watch them run past. All right, now let's go three blocks down and do it again. And it's like, I think Baker got to say like one line while they're out on the street, and that was it.
Yeah, you can tell like at the moment when he returns to the Louvre to check on the status of the theft. Mm-hmm. That was all done on VO, so there was absolutely no line actually delivered to the to security guards, yeah, outside the theater. So just, you know, I don't know whether it was a matter of they had some principal footage they wanted to get done while they were on the Eiffel Tower. The script hadn't been finalized yet, but they were shooting it all in one block,
mm-hmm,
and they figured they'd get the rest later, or, you know, just figure out a way to work it in at a later point. So that's why you don't have a whole lot of dialogue; you just have a lot of the three of them at various points running around. But
looks great.
But, all right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And it is one of the first opportunities where they were able to do a lot of practical location shooting like, mm-hmm, that on a larger scale. So for those who are not familiar with the basic premise of the story, how would you sum this up in a 30 word?
Time travel, MASH, and heist story with undertones of revenge. I don't know.
Okay. Well, no. You're hitting on some key points there. So, time travel is intrinsic to the story, on a couple of levels.
Yeah.
Both someone else attempting to do it and the Doctor utilizing it to carry the story forward. So that's good to see, because there's a lot of instances where you can get classic episodes where just like a New Who, where you get into a fixed location and that's it. The TARDIS is a sanctuary, but very seldom do you actually do any time traveling beyond getting yourself to the initial point of action.
Yeah.
You've got the heist or the actual crime being committed and that sort of a detective, the sleuthing out of what's actually going on. So there's your duality there. And then there is actually just kind of this interesting kind of sci-fi story that ties it all together, which is the justification for the big bad's premise, why they're doing what they're doing. So,
Haley, what did you think about this watching it through your first time? Like, what was your overall impression?
They did. It seemed like they maybe wrote a three-part episode and then stretched it into four, especially the first episode where there's a lot of scenery shots of Paris. I guess you got to justify going to Paris.
Mm-hmm.
But then once the story really got into gear, I enjoyed it a lot.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's kind of part and parcel for the classics era as well, because there were a lot of times where it was like, okay, well, we have four episodes. You gave us a two-episode script. We have to flesh this out somehow. Mm-hmm. Or then there were other times where it was like, okay, well, we've got four episodes. Let's turn it into 10. So it's... I don't think that's too far of a stretch, but
that's true. I mean, you could, if you take the general synopsis of what each episode is trying to convey, they follow a pretty logical progression. There's a bit of overlap. Obviously, there are maybe some things that get explained more than once that maybe didn't necessarily need to. If you were assuming that your audience was keeping, close tabs on everything that was going on.
Yeah, but at the same time, this is something that aired over the course of a month. So if they mentioned something in episode one, it's not too far afield to bring it up again in episode three or four.
Right, right. Just to make sure that everybody's staying on mm-hmm. pace here, because they don't do a previously on.
Right. the 45 seconds that you saw at the end of last week's episode, that's all you're getting at the beginning of this one, so you better have paid attention.
Yeah, precisely. They really come into it, other than the fact you get to watch the professor die over and over again, which is just the worst possible thing to watch.
That was awful.
We'll get to that. So we start off, obviously, as Haley said, we get a location set up where we're on the Eiffel Tower, the Doctor and Romana are traveling together. They're on a vacation. They've turned the randomizer off, so they've got a bit of control over where they're headed, and they've decided that they're going to take a break. That's going to end well. So we come to find out that as a result of the mention of this Count Scarlioni, everybody knows Count Scarlioni. No. Well, we've only just arrived on this planet. Sorry. There is a couple that is involved in some nefarious activities that the Doctor finds himself unwillingly drawn into because it involves a bracelet of particular interest. While they're visiting the Louvre, the Doctor spies a bit of alien tech that catches his attention and conveniently bumps his head against Detective Duggan's gun right. on his way to the floor. And we meet Duggan, who is probably one of the best lunkhead supporting characters in the history of Classic Who, hands down.
Yeah. Do we get to see him again, or was this his only appearance?
This is all the Duggan you get.
Oh, darn.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great transition because it's actually, up until this point, one of the consistent punching bags for the Fourth Doctor has been Harry. Harry is an imbecile! Harry. So Duggan takes that ball and runs with it, full force, eyes closed, towards a brick wall. And after a couple of bashes...
Anything you can do, I can do better.
So thoughts on the immersion that you get right off the first story here.
That was some fantastic effects happening right there in the open. Let me say that first.
Yes.
Yes. Well, throughout, really. But the story holds up really well, honestly, all the way through. I would have liked to get into the snappy dialogue that we had between the Doctor and the Count a little quicker. But other than that, just like, you cut a few minutes from just running the crane around Paris and you get more dialogue because the dialogue was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did love the dialogue and there were a couple lines in there that, when the Doctor and Romana are on top of the Eiffel Tower and he's describing Paris and it's like, it has, and she jumps in a bouquet, a spirit all of its own. It's like a wine. It has
a bouquet.
And he says it like it's completely his own idea, too.
But I love the extension to that metaphor. And he was like, it's a time all of its own. Like a fine wine. And she said, well, what year is it? This is 1979. Oh, so it's more like a table wine.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Classic. The 12th Doctor told us, he takes micro naps when other people are talking. He just skips ahead to his bits.
Exactly.
It's not a new trait.
No, yeah, that's true. Although one of the things that I loved was when the Countess was explaining what happened and how the Doctor got her bracelet, and she's like, it was well organized, I'm sure. I'm like, that's the only time in the entire series that I think that has ever been said about the Doctor.
Yeah. I have a plan. What is the plan? I haven't worked it all out yet, but I have a plan.
Something cool is going to happen. Watch.
Yeah, but the dialogue really is the gem of this entire story, because this is Adams at his finest. This is we get more into it. I think you see more of it by the time you get into episode two, and you get the confrontation where they're all brought in front of the Count and Countess, and they have that great discussion in the sitting room there. But even right off the bat here, I mean, you've got. Jay, you commented about the fact that there's the walking around Paris music.
Yeah, that music's not going to go away anytime soon.
But that's just it. I mean, you think about it. You can go back and you can watch a lot of Classic Who, and I mean a lot. And I can't really think, and I'm going to put this out to some of our other listeners out there who I know are as immersed in this as I may be at times. Can you think of another episode where there is actually a theme song for the story? Because that is written just for that episode. And we might even be able to drop this into the show notes. There's actually some of the original documentation available from the BBC production notes where they talk about some of the incidental music and those things. And there is discussion on some of those pages about the orchestration and the theme and variations on what is that, you know, Doctor in Paris theme that was written specifically for the story. So, you know, it's not the days of the, you know, some of those episodes that you listen to where it's just the synthesizer. You know, oh my God, I'm going to listen to this thing again. And you almost wish that they would rescore some of the classic stories. You know, as much as I love, you know, listening to somebody working a Moog synthesizer or whatever, but this one was, you know, full orchestration. And it's as Jay said, it gets stuck in your head. It's going to be there. You're always going to know. You could hear a little riff of that, you know, for 8 seconds and know exactly what, you know, where it drove from. In this particular episode of the story, you know, I'm thinking about some of the ancillary characters that get established. We love Duggan to death because he's just this ham-fisted, you know, goof.
I really think all he's in it for is the thumping.
Yeah, precisely. But the thing about this, he was sent, on an international, investigation. You know?
Yeah.
They entrusted this lunkhead to go study art theft, you know, in Paris.
So they thought he was even going to get lost on the way to the museum.
I don't know. I mean, he must have had some sort of reputation of being worth his salt, but
no, you know what it was like. Paris police called the Scotland Yard, and they're like, "We really need somebody to help us out here." And they're all like, "Oh man, do we really have to send? Hey, what's the name of your cousin? The one guy that he wants to be a cop. Can we send him?
The guy with the trench coat. Who's that guy?"
That's how I'm seeing this go play out. Like, well, Duggan, we've got a great job for you. This is really going to show your worth to the other guys in the yard. Like,
we need you to give back your bullet, Duggan.
Precisely. And then, you know, we've got obviously the professor is what he is. Okay, bit of a Jerry Lewis thing going on there. It's like a Russian Jerry Lewis. Go figure that one out. And then Herman the butler, who I think is just awesome. I love this guy. I love him to death. He's just whatever you say. Yes, well, I'll drag them in. I'll throw them down. Right. I'll go kill them. I'm done with them. Go kill them. In whatever way you feel appropriate.
He was like the preternatural Strax.
Absolutely perfect. Loved him to death. But you got to wonder though, how much did he actually know about Count Scarlatti's actual, you know? He knew he was tinkering in his laboratory down in the basement and so forth. But did he actually know, aside from the crimes, do you think he had any inclination to the fact that he was dealing with something otherworldly?
I don't think so, because the way that he reacted when he saw him at the very end was just very like, holy crap, what is this thing? And, you know, I don't think he was aware at all. Like, I knew he was probably aware that there was stuff happening like way above his pay grade, but I don't think that he believed anything, you know, extraterrestrial or supernatural or anything like that was going on.
I'm not paid to think.
Yeah.
So, but the reveal at the end of episode one, we get the sort of the bookend, because we get thrown cold into this weird, botched alien takeoff at the beginning of the episode. And by the time it closes, we get the fascinating mask reveal, that we've got, Squid Face is actually, our count, who amazingly packed all those tentacles under a beautifully movable mask and has hidden from his wife for years. Amazing. So, episode two starts getting into the crime. So now we're starting to deal with the theft of the Mona Lisa. So we've gotten into our time travel. Mm. We get the whole premise of the reason why Scarlatti is starting to do some of his, or has been putting out his his web of plans here to steal the Mona Lisa. We get the obviously the reveal of the multiple Monas. She has no eyebrows. You know, she actually doesn't have any eyebrows.
As soon as that popped up, the first thing I thought was like, I need to find some reference to Matt Smith not having eyebrows or something, yeah. And like smash those together. It'd be great.
Yep, you were waiting for him to say, I wonder what I would look like without eyebrows. Mm-hmm. And yet,
somebody's TARDIS is going.
I triggered it. That was me. I wonder what I did.
What did you do?
I looked at her funny. She spoke back to me. But yeah, so we get, this is probably, I would say, out of the four episodes, this is one where you get some of the best whip crack dialogue.
Yeah.
From the moment that, that the two of them are thrown into the sitting lounge.
I say, what a wonderful butler. He's so violent.
He's absolutely perfect. Now, what was your take, now that you get the chance to see the Count and the Countess, sort of working together, but not really together. Do you think that her character got a chance to really represent everything that it could have been, or was she just kind of a puppet?
Honestly, I felt like she was kind of a puppet, but at the same time, like I could tell that the script called for her to be an intelligent woman. Like I could tell that it was intended that this is someone that the Count had chosen specifically because she was intelligent and could operate alongside him and not just as a, you know, a tool to be used. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it really came along or came across that well, but that's like, you can tell there's shades of it in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, as far as obviously, if we're going to discuss the, you know, Baker just, you know, eating scenery with a fork and knife through this story, we also have to take a couple of minutes to recognize Romana's involvement throughout. I think it runs a very interesting line. Romana's always obviously recognized the fact that she is nearly an intellectual equal, obviously understands a lot of the technology and temporal references, so the doctor can talk on the highest level that he feels necessary as the situation presents itself, and she keeps tabs with them all along the way. She's not, I want to say, nearly the same intellectual level, because she does still rely on the doctor for some exposition from time to time. But, you know, when you see her with things like the puzzle box,
yeah,
you know, which is just, it's 5 seconds. It's just a quick kind of throwaway thing. She's like, oh, Countess, I doubt yeah, you'll be able to figure it out. Click, 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 click. Oh, look, it's a pretty bracelet. Oh, nice.
But it just, you know, the thing that I saw that kind of counterpointed how she and the doctor were is like, you know, when she agrees to help, Scarlatti or Sagaroth or whatever his name is, she like, you know, she gets taken in. She's like, oh no, I'm just helping him get back to his people and this, that, and the other. And like, she's very intelligent and she doesn't understand being manipulated very much, I guess. Mm. The doctor is the one that points out, like, no, he's using you to get this end that, you know, is not going to benefit anyone. Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, I thought I was just helping out some, you know, random person that was in need of assistance. Yeah.
Right. So, I think it, on a Gallifreyan, you know, on a Time Lord, Time Lady scale, this is her showing her youth. Mm-hmm. You know, she's only 125 years old, whereas the doctor is, you know, closer to his, you know, his 700, 800 year period at this point. So, you know, she should know better about the laws of time and the involvement or where it, you know, where certain things should not be interfered with along the timeline. So that kind of a, you know, this is really, by the time you get to, and you start to realize what's going on around the end of the third and the fourth episode, you're looking at the ultimate butterfly effect.
Yeah.
And she was helping that unravel because she was helping the one rather than the many, so to speak. And granted, the doctor is definitely going to be one who kind of flouts the laws when he feels it's necessary and where the meddling of the Time Lords is not warranted. But it's interesting in this particular case to see the fact that he's saying that this is where history has to run its course. Or I should say, the history to create the future. The future has to allow the past to happen, so the past supports the future that... Right, and then Doug and thump somebody.
Yeah.
So, but this is, I just thought that was kind of an interesting dynamic because, I mean, Romana is brilliant by comparison, you know, the way she's, you know, looking upon Earthlings is, you know, well, it's a Category 5 planet, you know, their technology is so limited and so forth. And yet some of the mistakes, if she was able to carry out some of the things that she was doing for what she thought was the greater good, well, you would have just completely undone the creation of life on Earth as we know it. Which I think is like, it's almost lost in this story, the magnitude of what they were up against in that brief moment on the, you know, the primordial ooze. So.
Yeah, but one thing I loved it, I think it was in the second episode, is like when they're all captured, when the Doctor and Ramon and Duggan are trapped in the cellar and whatnot, and they get out and they're, you know, the Doctor's going through the lab and Romana says something about the room being too small or something like that. And then the Doctor and Duggan start with their exchange. And if you watch in the background, you see Romana just walking through, picking things up and putting
it right, going back and forth.
And the whole time I'm sitting there like, what is she doing? Like, you know that she's doing something incredibly awesome. And right about the point you can't stand it anymore, the Doctor's like, and what is it that Romana's doing? I have no clue. Isn't that fascinating? Let's go find out. And it was just such a great, you know, something great that it almost seems was like, you know, just thrown together on set that day, because it's not something that, you know, I could see easily being scripted.
Right.
Not to the effect that it was actually done. If it was like something in the script, they really expounded on it and really made it great. And that added so much to Romana's character for me.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that she's off on her own doing this and like really accomplishing something completely competent. It was just such a great moment for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I have to imagine that to a certain degree, when you had this kind of a perfect chemistry on set, you know, you had that acting talent, you had that writing, from a direction standpoint, the episode is very strong as well. You know, take the editing for some of the additional location scenes and those things be what they are. But as far as just a matter of what was presented is just, you could tell that I think there was a general enjoyment. This was one of the real peak points in the production of the program in general, where all departments were just throwing so much of a labor of love into this.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and from the storyline perspective, I mean, you go ahead, you can take the costumes and take the alien masks and take all those things and just put them aside for a second. And if you can look through some of the production elements that we, from a 21st century perspective, look back and say, well, isn't that quaint?
Yeah.
But just look at the actual story itself. And this was a really interesting, genuinely complex storyline. You know, take the, even down to some of the small elements, like when the professor, is showing the egg to the chicken thing, and the Doctor reverses the polarity and brings it back to an egg stage, but leaves it running. And the fact that it all backs up and within the visibility of what's going on within that temporal distortion, you see it back up to the Jaggeroth. And that's just throwaway for the moment. You're like, oh, it shows an alien face. Isn't that weird? But think about it. They're just saying, they're actually telling you that scientifically, if you back it all up far enough genetically, you're backing yourself up to this species, which you should thank for everything.
Right.
But that's just, it's just like this little grain of information that's presented. So it's one of the reasons why I love the complexity of the story in general.
Yeah. I mean, it really is great. And that's one thing that we recently had some friends that hadn't watched any Classic Who or anything. And they started watching this. And that was one of the constant things, like, especially when they got to the end, was, okay, that was a good story. The story was fantastic. I wish it hadn't been so constrained by being in the 70s. Mm. And that seems to be the general consensus to people that, you know, jump into it now and don't have any awareness of Classic Who or that kind of thing. You really, I mean, it really stands out that this was made, you know, what, 40 years ago, 35, 40 years ago. And
especially when Duggan smashes into the wall
and the whole wall flexes.
If they had just added a little bit of sound foley, just some crunching and brick bashing sound, so it didn't just sound like foam blocks getting shoved around, it probably would have sold a little better.
Yeah, but
if they'd had somebody lean against the part of the wall that wasn't supposed to move.
Something like that.
Anyways.
Jerry, I'm on my lunch break. That's okay. You can just stand right here. It's fine.
Union break.
But yeah, I almost would love to see this redone nowadays, But at the same time, this is such a great story centered around the Fourth Doctor and Romana that you couldn't do it justice nowadays. Like it is something that has to be those two. And I don't know that you could do it justice today, but at the same time, it's like, how powerful a story could this be with today's technologies, with today's special effects?
Mm.
I have a question for you guys.
Yeah.
Do you think Moffat took the idea for Clara as the Impossible Girl from the Count being splintered through time?
Maybe on a subconscious level.
Yeah.
Okay.
The idea of saying there's nothing new under the sun. every story's been told before.
The main difference I'm seeing with the two of those is the fact that the Jaggeroth can communicate with himself or is aware of his other selves. Whereas okay. Clara, it seemed these were distinct individuals and not pieces of a whole.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. But the whole idea of some cataclysmic event that caused fragments of one's personality to occur across hundreds of years or greater. Yeah, I can absolutely see that being kind of, lifted to a certain degree. By the time we get around to about the third episode, which is where everything really starts to, all the pieces start to fall together. Now we understand, that present day, or by present day, I mean 1979, present day fraction of the Jaggeroth, who has had some sort of, trance state communication, with his other, splintered selves, which is interesting because of the fact it's not just a matter of something that occurs in his fragmented past. He then collects those memories. He actually is able to present that back through time so that when his 15th century fragment comes up against the Doctor in Da Vinci's workshop, he knows him to be the Doctor.
Mm.
So that's kind of an interesting little play around with that. But now we're starting to realize that this is this is where the crime, the heist aspect of it comes in. There's a lot of money involved in order to gather all the necessary tech in order to have the device that can cause the temporal bubble that he needs. So he needs to have some fantastic crime that gets him, tens of millions of dollars to pay for this stuff. So the idea of convincing Leonardo da Vinci to make 6 or 7 of these, what the heck? It sort of all ties together. I thought this was the particular point in the story where it really started to get kind of fun, because now you've got full cognizance of the time travel aspect. You've got all the workings of the crime that's being conducted and the reasoning why. You've got the fact that the villain is now fully realized and exposed. So now, we can do some serious mustache twirling and so forth. With one, two exceptions. As positive as this episode is out of the whole, it has two things that I think drive a nail right through it. One is the fact that the villain's exposition moment has to happen.
Right. Yeah.
Since you're about to die, I might as well tell you everything I'm about to do. Really?
It just can't be helped.
Just kill him. And then
kill him and write a book. Jeez.
And then there's the professor's death.
No, oh,
which is just horrible. The don't touch that switch. Hold on. And then you count to a good 20 seconds while he's standing there in the rays and shrivels up, which is horrible because they start the fourth episode making you sit through that 60-second sequence again.
I guess you missed it last time.
Yeah, this is what happens when a cut-rate actor is told to die on camera.
He even dies with a bad accent. Jeez.
Did you notice, though, that when they go back to the cafe and they're sitting there and there's the news broadcast on that's talking about the fact that the Mona Lisa was painted back in 1569? Like, wait a minute. They're in a Parisian cafe and the news is in English.
No. Yes. Translation matrix, remember?
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Yep.
It's because we, the audience, have been subjected to the TARDIS so much that it translates for us. Fantastic. Duggan's hearing French.
He doesn't even know he's hearing French. He's smarter
than
the average
bear. That's where it breaks
bear.
Down, because Duggan is English, and he's walking around Paris talking to everybody in English. So, yeah, doesn't hold up.
Yes. Well, thumps are universal.
Exactly.
But by the time we get around to the fourth episode, this is where, actually, if you read some of the accounts, you get there was some discussion about the fact that Adams was kind of tiring of the edits to the story and so forth, and that he kind of coasted through some of this. But I don't know if that's necessarily the case, because there were aspects in this fourth episode that maybe it's just because of the way that they chose to divvy out some of the information he'd originally written, but that I generally enjoyed. You know, the exchanges that they had when they went back 4 million years, and, you know, and Duggan's fascination with the fact of everything that's going on around him, and the Doctor and Ramona are just taking it totally casual, realizing what they've got to do. You know, the Countess is coming up and she's unraveling these tapestries and that she never noticed before. That there were, oh, look at this one-eyed, green-headed alien that happened to be on these Egyptian hieroglyphs that I never noticed before, and so forth. I just saw this whole thing as just fun, start to finish. Yes, certain aspects of it, if you want to sit there and pick it apart, you could. But at this point, I was invested in just the enjoyability of the story, and everything else kind of fell to the wayside. So, I mean, as far as your take on the big exposition of the fact that that if they don't, we're dealing with a threat here that's a little bit different scale than what we have been presented in previous classic episodes, because this is one that obviously affects the human race. Mm-hmm. You know, we see all these other world things where, oh, if we don't help them, this whole species is doomed. Well, this is our species this time around.
Yeah.
But there's no, I mean, there's Duggan, but there's no human companion shoving the Doctor like, hey, this is really important. This is like end of the world important.
No, but the one person who's the representative of the species involved is like, it's a spaceship. Ooh.
Thanks, Duggan.
But this is a Doctor who has... who's just traveled with Sarah Jane, who, you know, and he's very pro-human. You know, this isn't the first Doctor. This is a Doctor that cares very deeply about the human race. So if he doesn't get that push from other humans, then it's okay. Because he doesn't necessarily need it overly much.
Right.
It's a good thing, because if Duggan's the reason he's got to save the human race,
I'd have been like, well, no, let's go stop the spaceship. Let's just,
You know what? Because... as a result of it, this just goes to show that for those of you who strike first and ask questions later, you've got your justification.
You can save the human race with the most important punch in history.
You gotta adore that.
Yeah. But then, all right, so the problem that I have, and it's only because it's Douglas Adams and because most of everything that's happened up to this point has been so smart, is I'm sitting here thinking, okay, if Skaroth had actually stopped himself from taking off, that would have caused a paradox, because then he never would have been able to come back to tell himself to stop. So he would have taken off, but then he would have splintered and been able to come back and tell. And it bothers me.
It only depends on whether or not you recognize the paradoxical connotations as a part of alternate universes.
Yeah.
In one outcome, he succeeds and undoes himself. In another outcome, he fails and continues to cyclically go back and try and stop himself over and over.
Yeah, yeah, no. I know. It just, like, every time I watch it, that part sticks out to me, and I'm just like, oh, because that, I don't know.
Or you could say he was destined to fail. Like, there was no outcome where he succeeded.
Plus, he has a face you just want to punch.
Well, yeah.
Are you talking about the face, or the face that you can clearly see underneath that face?
No.
That's one thing that bothered me so much, is they kept on getting like real close on the eye, and you could actually see the actor's face underneath the mask.
Can't breathe in this thing.
Don't zoom in that much. Jeez.
Yeah, seriously, where's all the soft lighting?
No.
But I will say that this whole story just cemented in the fact, rewatching this today, just made me absolutely certain that I want to see Ramona return. I want to see the character come back. Once he finds Gallifrey, I want Ramona back.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you were to continue to kind of follow out what they've done, you know, with Lala Ward and the Romana character and carry through the extended content. She's become a, you know, obviously a power player. We've talked about that too. It's very seldom that we get a chance to, other than the master, have any kind of FaceTime with Gallifreyans who aren't just asshats. You know, we get the jerks of the Time Lord Council. We get the Guardians. We get the Valyard. You know, we get the worst end of it, and we don't get a chance to spend any time with the many, you know, play the odds, the many representatives of the race and of the planet that have merit and intelligence and value and heart and morals and so forth. we always get handed the jerks.
Yeah.
Because that makes a nice counterpoint to our beloved. So Romana is one of those refresher moments that says, okay, you know, this is, it's just like the idea of, you know, not all Vulcans are going to be, you know, I can absolutely agree with that. I'm holding out as well that we're not entirely done. It would require an immense amount of explanation to the viewing audience to try and figure out, unless they just go about it and just do some sort of a whip crack explanation, you know, don't even give the backstory or just something. Oh, it's lovely to see you again, kind of a thing. Just move on from there and let those people who are interested go and research it further. But yeah, I mean, she was just a phenomenal addition. You know, it's very seldom. And I think it's due time that we have another companion who can be, well, all right, I'm going to backtrack. I was going to say who can go toe to toe with the Doctor's intellect. But I would say that to a certain degree, that's exactly what they've been trying to do with Dr. Clara.
Yeah.
To a certain degree. Maybe not on an intellectual level, but just as far as an adaptability and being able to step up to situations as far as capability. But I think an intellectual equal that maybe not even River quite had. Mm-hmm. It was different with River. Intellectual equal, but not from the same cultural background. So there was something slightly different. But having a representative of Gallifreyan culture could be really interesting to put against the Doctor to sort of remind him of his roots.
Right.
That he keeps, you know, that he spends centuries trying to separate from.
Yeah, what I think would be kind of funny is actually have Romana be the next companion, but have her have a human companion of her own. Like, that way you've got the human companion in somebody that the Doctor and Romana have to explain things to so that the audience gets it. But that would be such an interesting take on the whole dynamic that I think it could be fun.
No. You had your pet hamster for a while. This is my pet hamster.
They bring back Duggan too.
Oh, jeez.
Or Duggan's son or something.
Well, no, go ahead and grab him because they left him so sad. You know, he's up there in the observation deck of the Eiffel Tower, just kind of waving morosely through the chain link.
Bye-bye, Duggan.
I've been exposed to the whole of time and space, and now all I've got is this lousy postcard. Poor guy.
Yeah. I don't know, but all in all, I have to say that this was a very strong choice for favorite episode. If you hadn't picked it, I probably would have. Because this is such a great, strong story. The execution may have left a little bit to be desired, but the story itself is just absolutely fantastic.
Mm. And it holds up. As Haley said, this is one of those ones where as soon as you kind of realize the sort of lens that you're seeing it through, mm-hmm. and you can file that away, the story absolutely holds strong.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what did we have as far as folks chiming in? When we mentioned what we were going to be talking about this week.
Ben said that City of Death is the perfect episode to show a Moffat fan who wants to see Classic Who. It is one of my favorite stories, part of the fantastic lines and the overall chemistry between the leads, which at the time was in the beginnings of the relationship. Is it a little long? Yes. Too much running around Paris, but the whole cast makes up for it with a wonderful villain played by Glover. All in all, a nigh perfect episode.
Yeah, yeah. I had noted as far as, you know, Glover, like when you see him appear back in Da Vinci's workshop and so forth, and you're thinking, all right, well, how, you know, they didn't really give us the explanation. And it isn't until we jump into the next episode where we understand that, okay, this is a splinter of the Jaggeroth. Okay, we're starting that part of the story. But I almost, when he has that weird moment where he's communicating with all of his factions, and you see him, you know, with the in the Egyptian motif and so forth, and we're leaping through all of these instances. I almost wanted to see Baker having to deal with some of those other splinters, just to see the fact that he was, you know, going to see if he could, you know, unravel this or undo it at some point along the way by tripping up as many of the pieces as he could, you know, like a chess match. If he could if he could take enough pawns off the board, he could undo this.
That would have been interesting, but at the same time, I feel like his, you know, his main goal was the current one, so to speak, the one in the modern day that, you know, that's the one that was executing the plan and everything like that. And if he could stop him, the rest of them didn't matter. Mm-hmm. And he was only dealing with the one in the Renaissance time because, you know, he happened to show up there.
Mona Lisa collection.
Yeah. So if you had done more than that, it would have almost felt like they had cheated you out of part of the story.
Okay. No, I get that. Although I did love, as far as just, you know, the whole idea of going back to Dear Leo, you know, leaving notes for him. And the reverse writing.
Yeah, that was great.
And that's just one of those little quick throw-ins. There were all sorts of interesting little continuity drop-ins. The fact that the speed reading, you know, when they're sitting down in the cafe and he goes through the book really quickly, you know, he lagged a little bit in the middle. But that's something that you didn't really get since the Hartnell and the Troughton eras, the fact that he could run through a book in a couple of minutes, or the reverse writing, or all these other things. But then again, there's also like just that little throwaway dialogue. It's just for fun, but it just added to the enjoyment. It was the whole Shakespeare reference.
Yeah.
Oh, I knew this boy. He never spoke a word. He was so taciturn. And I told him, you know, if you have something to say, say it. He ended up writing a few things. William Shakespeare was his name. You know?
Yeah.
Or the mixed metaphor line.
Yeah, that was great. Although the fact that she was smoking over an original Shakespeare manuscript.
Dude, it was the 70s. It's fine.
I know, I understand that, but I'm just like, oh, dear God.
Goddamn pretentious cigarette holders.
I'm surprised they didn't have people smoking in the Louvre. I mean, really.
I'm sure. Well, and then we got our purists that say, oh, the Mona Lisa wasn't that big. It's only slightly larger than a postcard.
Yeah.
You can only see it from 40 feet away. And
yeah, I was.
Well, that doesn't sell well on camera.
That's one thing that stood out. Like, as soon as I saw it pop up, I'm like, wait a minute, that's way too big. But I loved seeing John Cleese in the art museum. Him talking about the TARDIS was just absolutely brilliant.
Well, the fact that he decided to park the thing in a modern art museum gallery just down the road there, so it's surrounded by all these other interesting pieces. But the fact that when it disappears in front of them, it's exquisite.
Yeah.
Exquisite.
It's like it's all part of the piece or something. It was great. Mm-hmm.
Goddamn performance art.
Oh, man. So, Haley, what did you think of your first Baker episode? What was your takeaway from all of this?
I can see why people like this doctor. I get it. just every scene where he just went on for a bit, you know, just running off at the mouth. That's really where I think this episode shone.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that, I mean, Baker is exquisite at doing that. I love anytime they give him like even 45 seconds of uninterrupted, just, hey, you know what? Just talk. It's always gold.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But. And the fact that he could run at full tilt with 16 yards of fabric hanging around his neck and not once trip himself or his co-hosts up there.
This is before blooper reels, probably. I wonder how many shots there are of him.
I don't know. He'd been running around for a couple seasons. I think he had it down to a science at that point.
His first series. But yeah, it's, from here, you know, you can kind of jump in either direction. You can either backtrack into some of the preceding episodes and get to see Ark in Space and those things. You could jump forward and see things like, or even the stuff that's on, Netflix. They've got they spend a decent amount of time for the Classic Who collection on the Baker years. So you can see things like The Leisure Hive and some of those others, which is another Romana, story, interesting one. You get more canine rather than just a one line reference where he walks in. Oh, canine, how are you? I'm like, no, come on.
All right. I have to admit that gave me a big old smile though, because it was just, you didn't need more than that. It's like, oh, yeah, canine. I would have loved to have seen
the dog
in
the house.
I would have loved to have seen him. Yeah. But at least we got that.
Yeah. So,
well, the thing was kind of a pain to work with, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mentioning things like The Leisure Hive, just by the time they started working out some of the different models or putting the shell down on other devices, they actually had him going across the beach at Brighton, you know, so they, in the early stages, back in like when Elizabeth Sladen was on and things, like it would run up against a pebble or something on the set and stop cold because the casters would get stuck and they'd have to, you know, reshoot the scene. But then they said, well, for the scenes when we don't actually have to have all of the technology going and we just have to have them in motion, why don't we just take something like an RC car and just put the shell down over it? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've got it bounding across the beach. So,
I've got to say, one of the stories I love hearing, and I can't remember who was telling it, but one of the companions was talking about how they would have John Leeson, who did the voice of K-9, was always like in this little sound booth and whatnot. And they would have the cord running from his microphone to K-9 and then another one going back. So he could actually, you know, deliver his lines to the actors and hear their responses and stuff like that. So she was saying that between sets, you would see Tom Baker sit, and the two of them love to do like crosswords together. Mm-hmm. So you would see Tom Baker sit down next to K-9 and start asking K-9 for help with this crossword. And John Leeson would be back there in the booth doing his own crossword, but it looked like, you know, it looked like the doctor sitting down with K-9 doing a crossword together.
But that was just a great time for the set too. Another thing with Leeson is during rehearsals and things when they didn't want to bring the prop out, he would sit there and get down on all fours on set and represent. So they would speak down to their proper sight lines.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's just, we're getting away from the story at hand. That's kind of the dedication.
Yeah, but I have to agree with Ben though that I think this is a great episode to introduce people to, because let's be honest, if you don't like this episode, if you can't get past the 70s of it, you're not going to be able to find another episode in the classic series that really is going to catch your attention.
Very few. There may be a couple others I might keep on that short list. You know, maybe something like The Time Warrior or maybe, but yeah, I mean, this is definitely a litmus test.
Yeah. So, I mean, you show this to people and if they're like, wow, that, you know, that was interesting. I didn't care for the special effects, but the story was good. Then you've got a basis. You can be like, okay, there might be some more we can do here. But if somebody's not going to, yeah, if they're not into this, if they can't do it, then you're best to be like, you know what? Okay, just, you've gotten your taste. Go back to the new stuff, and then you can read about the references on Wikipedia.
I was going to make a horrible statement about other programs that I can't watch the early stages for, but
all right. You'll contain yourself.
No, he won't.
No, you know, I won't. You know, I would rather watch I'll jump into Buffy on season 3 and just read the synopses of seasons 1 and 2.
Yeah.
The last, like, 6 episodes of season 2 of Buffy are good, but yeah.
2 wasn't horrible. The first one was kind of rough, but
really. And the second one is inconsistent. Those ones are much better after you love the characters to go back and watch.
Or if you've been drinking.
Well, yes.
Yeah. Or if you just don't know any better and that's the only thing you could find on Netflix to catch your interest.
Is that really how we were in the 90s? We were ignorant. Anyway, all right, we digress.
Incidentally, I did drive past Buffy's high school while I was out in L.A. for Gallifrey, though.
Yeah.
Interesting. I was like, wait, I know that place. It's weird. But anyway. Well, let's go ahead and go to the news.
So for those of you, you know, like keeping track on a calendar or something, I suppose you might kind of recognize that we're kind of in an anniversary year for people that think the show started in 2005.
I love the fact that, you know, for Doctor Who, we celebrate the 50th anniversary, and then like a year and a half later, we celebrate the 10th anniversary. It just, yep. it works for this show. It really does.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so was it March 26th, I believe, was the day? Yeah, so I'm going to put the call out. So on March 26th, go out and somehow, with non-destructively, I'm not calling for graffiti or anything, but like sidewalk chalk or something like that, go out and write Bad Wolf anywhere that you possibly can.
Or go up to a random stranger and just say, run.
There you go. Dress up as a mannequin and start attacking people. That's always fun. But yeah.
Wait, you don't already do that?
Only on March 26th.
Gotcha.
Okay. That's why I spend usually April, I spend in jail, but you know, it's neither here nor there.
I thought it was because of taxes, but okay.
No, they just figure that out once I'm already there. But, but then, so, you know, jumping forward 10 years, we've got series 9 that actually is in filming right now. And we're starting on, block 3, the third block of episodes starting.
Yeah. So, you know, kind of based on their location shoots, I mean, we had heard, obviously, they were doing some of their shooting back in Spain previously, which meant, you know, they typically use that for some of their off-world locations because it looks kind of, you know, rocky and sandy and so forth. And based on how you cast the lens and things, you can sort of get your different, you know, space landscapes. Now they're doing some shoots of things like just outside Cardiff proper at Margam Castle and so forth, which means they might be doing some period pieces. And we'll see. I mean, this is, we're deeply into conjecture phase
yeah.
at this right now, where we get really nothing, but the smallest bit of news is just sends the dogs howling.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, somebody says something about Doctor Who. Quick, write it down. But I mean, that's the point that we're at, is because we're getting so little at this point that anything kind of piques our interest.
Thankfully, though, note that we have not been dealing with any leak stories.
Yay!
Yeah, honestly, I think this is a good thing. You know, either this is just a matter of the fact that people are starting to be slightly less jerks about it, or that they've really ratcheted down their information streams.
So I'm going to go with option B.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, there's no stories of the first 5 episodes getting leaked out there. No scripts being left in cabs. They've kind of
Moffat sat everyone down. Who enjoys having steady income?
Yeah, exactly. I seriously think that after everything last year, they really took a look at everything and said, we have to lock this down. We have to get it under control. And they really have started working on it.
Mm-hmm. Just hiring craft services teams who don't speak English. Like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but then the next bit of news that we've got is actually kind of coincidentally, Douglas Adams' script of City of Death is going to be adapted to a novel.
Okay, it's oddly, obviously, with all of the novelizations that have been done for classic episodes, this is one that, for one reason or another, really never got worked back into full story format. So, no pressure or anything. they've handed the job over to a writer who has had some experience. James Goss has taken the shot of stories and those things and worked them back into radio adaptations and things, and has written 2 other Doctor Who novels along the path, neither of them necessarily being Adam stories. But it's interesting to note that he had head-on addressed the fact that you're dealing with probably one of the, if not the most recognizable British science fiction author of the 20th century. And well, all right, yeah, there'll be some people that are arguing on Asimov, but the fact that there's a writing style involved there, that you're taking someone who was a novelist to begin with, who had been writing these television stories. So now you're taking one of his stories and working it back into a novel and trying to be true to the format. No pressure.
Yeah.
But he acknowledges that and says, well, everyone's going to tear me to shreds anyway. So as soon as I acknowledge the fact that I'm going to take a lot of flack from all sides, I can, you know, that's a pressure release and I can just enjoy it. So I'm genuinely interested to see what he ends up doing with the City of Death story.
Yeah.
Plus, it may deal with some of the pacing or you know, sort of storytelling issues that we were
There's going to be a whole chapter that just says, they run through the streets of Paris. They pass a car. They pass this intersection. That's how they're going to translate it. Mm. It's going to be great.
It's a picture book.
17 pages.
But it's a pop-up book, so.
Then the last bit of news that we've got is, this is kind of interesting. There's a little video. It's about 30 seconds. It's Peter Capaldi as the Doctor inviting people to the Doctor Who experience from 5 different TARDIS control rooms.
Yes. Yes. This was fantastic. Now, Capaldi has done a couple of quick promotional bumps for the Doctor Who experience in Cardiff, where I will be in just a matter of months. This particular one is one where I'm sort of getting the impression that says that you may have the opportunity on their primary exhibition hall floor to be able to see the different console displays, short of obviously the large scale one where they do all of the productions, which at certain times during the year you can have access to. I think right now is one of the periods, obviously, because of the production blocks where you cannot actually tour the live set. But if you do catch it in what they consider the off season, you actually can walk the standard floor. I can't imagine. But this one is a lot of fun. As far as what they put together for this one, it's a lot of fun because it takes your 12th Doctor through everything from Hartnell's console, the round things, the buttons. So,
yeah.
And delivers it in a way that's entirely his. But it just, mm-hmm. it has fun with the fact that it's, the set keeps changing behind him and his, he's dealing with like Tennant's steampunk console.
And I love the fact the only thing you see him do on that set is like smash something with a mallet.
because it kicks off sparks and no one beats up on the console like Capaldi does. It's just a lot of fun. Go ahead. We'll put it in the show notes, and it's just an enjoyable little piece. I got to imagine that's for someone who is as much of a long-term fan as he is, it must have been a great experience for him as well to be able to play around with it before everything got all swipey.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, but. That's about all the news that we've got this week. So next week we're going to be continuing our favorite episode arc with my pick. And honestly, this is something I struggled with all week long. I've been trying to come up with which one I wanted to pick for this because let's face it, Kier picked the obvious one. And there are so many that mean so much to me that it's difficult to pick one and say, this one is my absolute favorite. But there's one that I always think of when I think of episodes that I love and that, honestly, I use this in my initial barrage of here, watch some Doctor Who. This is usually the second or third episode that I get somebody to watch before they, you know, finally sink their teeth into the show.
Fear her.
Yep.
Wow. You just absolutely nailed it. You're just a jerk. this is The Girl in the Fireplace. And I love this story. And again, it's one that, you know, it deals with the time travel aspect because we don't get that often enough. But this is just, it's a fun episode and it's one of those that just really, you know, portrays the show as it is now. So that's the one that we're going to be watching next week.
Okay. Don't twist my arm.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, this has been episode 130 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, Duggan smash!
Puny Time Lord. And this is Kier saying, honestly, I really think we're all in it just mainly for the thumping.
And this is Haley saying, that's a spaceship.
I notice a theme with all of our quotes. Just some of the most brilliant dialogue of any of Classic Who writing, and we all grab Duggan's durr lines. That's great.
I think that says more about us than the episode, but we will see you guys next week.
We'll see.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2015.